Turn your tax refund into a new landscape with Menards. Make this the year you check that project off the list. Create stunning patios and build strong retaining walls with our huge in-stock selection of beautiful concrete blocks ready to take home today. Plus, easily build and design your own raised garden beds with our garden block. On sale now. Check out our weekly flyer and start saving on landscape blocks now at Menards. Save big money
at Menards. Sylvia's Synergy Effect, brought to you by Synergy Home Care.
Getting back in the kitchen got mom back into life. After her stroke, she felt uncomfortable doing what she used to do. But with her Synergy caregiver, Emma, things changed. She got help at home and regained the confidence to get back to her old recipes. Now the hardest thing is getting mom to stop making her biscuits. So good.
We believe getting back to what you love can keep you moving forward. Find your Synergy Effect with Synergy Home Care.
Welcome to the Divergent Files podcast.
Let's start with the normal assumption. Flood myths are symbolism. Ancient people trying to explain storms. Every culture had rivers. Rivers flood. End of story. That's the standard take. Now here's the part we usually skip over. Around 12,900 years ago, the planet's climate shifts violently. The end of the last ice age doesn't taper off gently. It snaps. Temperatures in the North Atlantic region drop several degrees in a few decades. Then, about 1,200 years later, they snap back the other direction. Fast warming, ice collapse, sea levels rising rapidly. That's not mythology, that's ice core data. So, hold on to that. Because if humans were living mostly along coastlines, in river valleys at the time, which they were, then the most resource-rich settlements on Earth would have been sitting exactly where sea levels were about to move. And today, those coastlines are underwater. Now, layer this on top. Across Mesopotamia, across India, across China, across the Pacific, and across the Americas, you find a repeating story. Not just water, a reset. And not just a reset, a sequence. A warning, a moral collapse. One group preserved, a prepared vessel, total wipe, restart, and then teachers appear. Different gods, different names, but the same order. And that's where this episode really starts. Because the real question isn't why do flood myths exist? It's this. Why do these stories behave like a coordinated memory system? So by the end of this episode, you'll understand why that question is harder to dismiss than it sounds. Because floods don't synchronize across continents. Something else does. This is Divergent Files. If this were just about heavy rain, the stories would wander. They'd contradict each other. One village blames a river. Another blames a god. Another says it was just a bad season and moves on. That's what folklore usually does. It drifts. It forgets structure before it forgets names. But this one doesn't drift. And that's the itch. So start in Mesopotamia, in the Epic of Gilgamesh. The survivor is Unapishtim. The god Ea warns him ahead of time. Not vague intuition, instructions, specific ones. Built it this way, seal it, bring the seed of all living things. The world gets wiped. He survives. And afterward, life doesn't just randomly pop back up. Order returns. Now, bring it home. In Genesis, it's Noah. Advance warning from God. Exact measurements for the ark. Animals preserved two by two. Global wipe language, then a covenant, and then restart. Different theology, but the same skeleton. Then you slide over to India. In the Shetapatha, Brahmana, it's Manu, who's warned by a fish, later identified with Vishnu. He builds a vessel, survives the flood, performs rituals that reestablish human order. In Greece, you have the Deukalion and Piraeus. Zeus wipes out humanity, a chosen pair survives in a constructed vessel. They repopulate the world. Then you have China, which preserves the great flood of Gun Yu, civilizational collapse tied to catastrophic flooding. Then Yu the Great restructures the land, not chaos, reorganization. Now move into Mesoamerica. In the Popol Vuh, the gods destroy a previous version of humanity.
And heart of sky brought a great flood.
A wipe, a reset, a new age. Among Polynesian traditions, Hawaiian lore, for example, you've got Nu'u, who survives a great flood and begins again. And in parts of the Andes, there are stories of a pair escaping in a sealed container while everything else goes under. Now look, you can argue theology all day long. That's fine. Names change, gods change, cultural flavor changes. But the order? The order holds. Someone knows first. Something at the civilizational level breaks. A small group is preserved. A prepared vessel carries life, animal seeds, sometimes knowledge. The world is wiped and the new age begins. And in a lot of these traditions, someone shows up afterward who understands building, law, measurement, the stuff that actually makes civilization work. That's not how random weather memory behaves. If this were just scattered river floods across thousands of years, the structure would scatter too. Instead, it stays intact like somebody kept the outline and swapped the cast. Legends usually blur around the edges, but this one doesn't. It keeps its spine. Now here's where this stops being just a mythology conversation. Because around 12,900 years ago, the planet does something rude. The last ice age is ending. Temperatures are climbing. Ice sheets are pulling back. It's slow, messy, but it's moving in the right direction. Then, and this isn't dramatic language, this is ice core data, it snaps. Temperatures in Greenland drop hard. Not over 10,000 years, not over some vague prehistoric blur. Instead, in decades. You can see it in the ice layers like someone yanked the thermostat. That period is called the Younger Dryas, and it's not subtle. And when I say not subtle, I mean this isn't guesswork pulled from cave art. Greenland ice cores, GRIP and GISP2, slow the temperature drop clearly, layer by layer. You can count it in like the tree rings. The shift is abrupt, not a slow fade, a snap. Across North America, there's something called the black mat layer. Dark organic rich sediment sitting right at the Younger Dryas boundary in multiple regions. Same time window, same strange deposit. Not everywhere, but enough places to raise eyebrows. And right around that same stretch of time, megafauna disappear. Mammoths, mastodons, giant ground sloths. The extinction window overlaps the climate snap. Not perfectly and not clean, but overlapping enough that scientists have been arguing about it for decades. That's not mythology lining up with mythology. That's sediment lining up with ice lining up with bones. Ocean circulation shifts. Meltwater pours into the North Atlantic. Weather systems go sideways. Megafauna start disappearing. Entire ecosystems destabilize. And humans are not living on mountaintops at this point. They're living along the coasts, river mouths, lowlands, because that's where the food is. So now fast forward a little over 1,000 years. The cold phase ends, and the planet snaps back again. Rapid warming. Ice sheets collapse. Sea levels rise, and not politely. Coastlines that used to exist are now under hundreds of feet of water. And here's the part nobody lingers on. If most early human settlements were coastal, and they were, then the physical evidence of anything sophisticated built before that sea level rise would now be underwater. Not buried, gone. We're talking about coastlines that were miles farther out during the Ice Age. That's where people would have fished, traded, and settled. Today, those shorelines are submerged. Sea levels have risen roughly 400 feet since the last glacial maximum. 400. That's not a puddle problem. That's an entire continental shelf problem. There's even a term for one of the faster jumps, Meltwater Pulse 1B. Around 11,500 years ago, sea levels rising meters in relatively short geological timeframes. Not a bathtub filling slowly, more like a shoreline stepping backward in human lifetimes. In the North Sea, there used to be a landmass called Doggerland, with forests, rivers, game animals. People lived there. Today, it's underwater. Southeast Asia used to be something called Sundaland, a massive connected landmass before the seas came in. Now, most of it is drowned beneath the Java Sea and the South China Sea. Beringia once linked Siberia to Alaska, not a frozen hallway, a real ecological zone. That coastline? Also gone. So we've mapped ancient river valleys offshore, entire drainage systems that no longer exist above water. And the sonar doesn't lie. The rivers are still there, but the land just isn't. And here's the quiet part. Underwater archaeology is brutally expensive, slow, underfunded, and we barely scratch continental shelves compared to how much dry land we dig. It's easier to brush sand off a ruin in the desert than send submersibles into murky water hoping to get lucky. So when people say, where's the evidence? Well, some of it might be under a few hundred feet of ocean, which means if there were complex settlements there, not Atlantis with glowing crystals, just organized, skilled coastal cultures, they're not waiting for archaeologists with brushes. They're at the bottom of the ocean. Now, I'm not saying we've proven a lost super civilization. That's lazy thinking. But I am saying this. We know there was a violent climate shift. We know sea levels rose dramatically. We know humans were living in exactly the areas that got swallowed. And we know that cultures across the globe remember a catastrophic water reset. Now, it's not proof, but it is pressure. And when geology and global memory start leaning in the same direction, you don't shrug that off as coincidence. You at least stop pretending it's ridiculous. Okay, so let's talk about the forgetting. Because if this really was a hard reset around 12,900 years ago, if coastlines got swallowed and people were living on those coastlines, then a lot of early human story didn't just fade, it went underwater. And underwater archaeology? Well, it's not Indiana Jones, it's mud. Sonar that looks like static. Boats that cost more per day than your house payment. Weather that cancels the whole thing because the ocean doesn't care about your PhD. So what do? Well, we study what's easy to dig, which means we build our timeline mostly from land sites that survived sea level rise. So think about that for a second. If your entire childhood photo album fell into a lake and you rebuilt your life story using whatever was left in the attic, would that story be complete? No, of course not. It would be convenient. Now here's where people get twitchy. Institutions don't like moving timelines. Not because there's a secret villain in a dark room, because careers are built on the current model. Grants get funded based on the current model. Textbooks get printed based on the current model. Changing the timeline isn't just updating a date. It means admitting you were wrong in public. And humans, well, humans are allergic to that. For decades, American archaeology ran on something called Clovis First. The idea was clean and confident. The first people in the Americas showed up around 13,500 years ago, period. Nice, tidy, teachable. Then Monteverde in Chile shows up with evidence pushing habitation earlier. And instead of celebration, what happens? Friction, resistance, panels, reanalysis. A lot of, are we sure? It took years before pre-Clovis became broadly accepted. Not weeks, years. Same thing with Göbekli Tepe, dated to around 9,600 BC. Massive stonework, organized labor, ritual architecture that doesn't look like we just discovered fire yesterday. And when that hit the field, it didn't get a parade. It got quiet recalibration. You could almost hear the timeline stretching. So here's my point. If early coastal settlements are underwater, if underwater archaeology is expensive and rare, If career incentives reward staying inside the accepted box, then forgetting doesn't require a mastermind. It just requires friction. We don't have amnesia because someone erased the hard drive. We have amnesia because the file cabinet sank and nobody budgeted a submarine. And when new evidence shows up, it has to fight its way through committees. And here's where it gets interesting. If the flood myths are carrying a memory of a reset, and the physical evidence of that reset is mostly underwater, and the timeline that says nothing organized existed before 10,000 BC was defended pretty aggressively for decades, then the anomaly isn't the myth. The anomaly is how hard we resist moving the starting line. Sometimes we don't forget because the past vanished. Sometimes we forget because it's inconvenient to dive for it. Before we start blaming institutions or shadowy forces, let's talk about something much simpler: human memory. We are not hard drives, we're storytellers. Anthropologists who study oral cultures have tracked how stories survive across generations. The pattern is consistent. Details fade fast. Names go. Exact timelines blur. Within a few hundred years, unless something is written down or ritualized, precision erodes. But structure hangs on. If something catastrophic happens, people don't preserve data. They preserve warning. So, for example, don't build there. Don't ignore the signs. Do it this way next time. Over time, that warning becomes a story. There's real research on tsunami memory in the Pacific. Some villages remember which ground is unsafe because of waves that hit centuries ago. The science of the event gets wrapped in spirits and gods. The survival behavior remains. The brain compresses trauma. When something is too large to process cleanly, we simplify it into symbols that travel well. For example, water, fire, sky anger. Not because people were primitive, because that's how the nervous system carries shock forward. Now here's the part that matters. When disaster hits, not everyone survives equally. Some people panic. Some people organize. Some people just know what to do. If you're watching the group that had tools, plans, maybe knowledge others didn't, you're not going to remember their technical background 10 generations later. You're going to remember that they were different, prepared. Over time, competence turns into myth. Not because they were aliens, but because trauma makes the capable look superhuman in hindsight. This is why so many flood accounts don't just describe water, they describe selection, instructions, survival by design. That's not mystical, that's psychology. Now stretch that out 10,000 years. That's hundreds of generations. If a real catastrophe hit at the end of the Ice Age, you wouldn't expect clean, dated narratives. You'd expect compressed memory. A warning, a collapse. Few survive, rebuild. That's how trauma leaves a fingerprint. Combine that with the fact that writing didn't exist yet, and you combine it with coastlines that are now underwater, and then you combine that with institutional inertia we already talked about, then amnesia stops looking mysterious. It starts looking inevitable. We didn't lose the story because it was weak. We lost the detail because human memory is built from grandchildren and for grandchildren, not millennia. And what survives that long? Shape, not spreadsheets. The flood myths may not be exaggerations. They may be what's left after 10,000 years of compression. And if detail erodes that fast, then something had to preserve the knowledge long enough for civilization to restart. Here's the part that doesn't sit right. After the flood, whatever it was, civilization doesn't crawl out of the mud confused and feral for 5,000 years. It restarts. And not in a we figured out fire again way. In a who already knew how to measure the sky type of way. Take Göbekli Tepe in modern-day Turkey, for example. Dated to around 9,600 BC. Massive stone pillars. Precise carvings. Astronomical alignments debated, sure. But nobody argues it's sophisticated. That's right after the Younger Dryas ends. That's not a long runway. Now look at early Egyptian structures, then early Mesopotamian city planning, then early Mesoamerican calendar systems. You don't see clumsy first drafts. You see people who understand geometry, seasonal cycles, orientation. Now, I'm not saying they were flying helicopters. Calm down. I am saying this, though. For hunter-gatherers who supposedly just barely survived the planetary mood swing, they get organized pretty darn fast. Agriculture locks in. Monument building appears. Timekeeping gets serious. And here's where the myths slide back in quietly. After the flood, in a lot of these traditions, someone shows up. In Mesopotamia, figures like Oannes, described as a being who comes from the sea and teaches writing, law, and agriculture. In Mesoamerica, Quetzalcoatl brings knowledge and order. In the Andes, Viracocha emerges after the flood and teaches civilization. These aren't random gods throwing lightning bolts. These are instructors. And that's an odd detail to preserve if this is just, it rained a lot. Now, pause. If a civilization collapses hard enough, the people who survive aren't equal in knowledge. Some know how to farm. Some know how to build. Some know how to measure stars. Most don't. Knowledge concentrates in survivors. So if you're a less advanced group watching a small organized remnant show up after catastrophe and start laying out systems, what are you going to call them? Engineers or gods? This is where it gets uncomfortable, because the archaeological record shows rapid organization. The myths show returning teachers, and the geology shows a hard reset window. Now, that doesn't prove a lost high-tech empire, but it does make this hard to ignore. Resets usually leave chaos. This one leaves structure. And structure doesn't appear from nowhere. After the Younger Dryas ends, roughly 11,700 years ago, climate stabilizes. People don't just survive, they get super organized. And that's the part that should make you lean back a little. Because when survival mode is fresh, when you just crawled out of a climate chaos, the normal human move is short term. Eat, shelter, don't die. But instead, in the Fertile Crescent, they start locking down wheat and barley. Over in China, along the Yellow River, they're doing the same thing with millet and rice. Later on, in Mesoamerica, corn gets domesticated. Different continents, different crops, but the same move. And we're told it all just kind of happened. Now hold on. You don't accidentally invent farming. You don't wake up one morning and go, hey, what if we carefully replant the seed from the plants that didn't die for the next 20 years? Selective breeding isn't luck. It's watching. It's patience. It's knowing what you're trying to get. That's multi-generation thinking. That's planning past your own lifetime. And somehow, right after the planet stops convulsing, that kind of thinking starts showing up all over the map. And then monument building shows up early. So we need to stop pretending this part isn't strange. Göbekli Tepe around 9600 BC, with massive pillars, carved reliefs, coordinated labor. That's not, we just figured out seeds. That's organized. Jericho's out there stacking stone into a tower. Then Egypt comes along and starts laying blocks so tight and straight that modern engineers still squint at it and argue in conference rooms about how it was done. Now, here's where I'm going to push back a bit. We're told this was all slow and messy. Small tribes, trial and error, rope, copper chisels, wet sand, a lot of we'll figure it out. And listen, ancient people weren't dumb. That lazy narrative needs to die. They watched the sky. They tracked seasons. They understood stone better than most of us understand drywall. But here's the part we don't interrogate enough. Why does big, math-heavy construction show up in bursts? Not just one group getting ambitious. Clusters. Same obsession with straight lines, angles, and stone that weighs more than your house. Why pyramids or megalithic architecture in Egypt, Mesopotamia, Mesoamerica, the Andes, later China, across the Pacific? Different materials, different styles, same impulse. Build massive structures, align it to the sky, lock into cardinal directions. And here's the crazy part. These civilizations were not supposed to know the others existed. There were no shared blueprints or global Zoom calls. Yet, large stone architecture with astronomical alignment shows up on multiple continents. Look, you can call that coincidence if you want. You can. But it's one hell of a coincidence. So either everybody on Earth woke up at roughly the same stretch of history and said, you know what would be fun? Let's stack enormous stone mountains and point them at the sky. Or there's a chunk of human history missing. We already know humans were crossing open water tens of thousands of years ago. Australia didn't fill itself up by accident. Somebody built something that floated and said, yeah, let's go that way. So this idea that pre-Ice Age humans were just clueless land drifters who never talked to anybody, that doesn't really hold up. If people were living along coastlines before the seas rose, and of course they were, because fish and trade beat staring at rocks inland, then when the water came up, those places went under. So now stack this up. Hard climate reset. Coastlines erased. Small groups survive. Some of them know things most people don't. Myths say teachers show up. And then, right after stabilization, complexity pops up in clusters. That doesn't scream Atlantis with glowing crystals, but it does make the everyone figured out geometry separately in total isolation at the exact same time story feel quite convenient. Civilization doesn't usually wake up one morning on three different continents and decide, you know what we need? Monument-scale stone math. That's not how most systems behave. Either humans everywhere reinvented the same advanced impulses all at once, or we're missing a massive chapter. All right, so we've got a hard climate snap around 12,900 years ago. Fast cooling, then later, fast warming. Ice moving like it got shoved. Sea levels climbing, and cultures all over the place, all over the planet, remembering something that feels bigger than a storm. So what does that? Well, the textbook answer starts with meltwater. Big ice sheets melt. Fresh water dumps into the North Atlantic. That messes with the ocean conveyor belt, the AMOC, the AMOC. And when that slows down, temperatures drop fast. That model has weight. It's not crazy. It explains the cooling phase. But here's the itch. Meltwater is what happens after ice destabilizes. Ice doesn't wake up one morning and say, I think I'll panic. Something pushes it. So, what pushes it? Well, that's where the comet theory comes in. Researchers found platinum spikes, tiny spherules, nanodiamonds, and some younger Dryas boundary layers. The idea is a comet fragment explodes in the atmosphere, lights up half the planet, destabilizes ice sheets, and kicks off the cascade. It's dramatic. It would explain suddenness. But here's where it gets messy. Some labs find the signatures. Some don't. Some sites show the markers. Others shrug. And the big one? The crater. The thing you'd expect if a chunk of space rock slammed the planet hard enough to flip climate systems. Well, it's still not sitting there with a sign on it. Now, maybe it was an airburst. Maybe it fragmented. Maybe it scattered. Sure, that's possible. But you start noticing how many maybes are doing heavy lifting here. So let's press this a little. If a comet fragment detonated hard enough to shove ice sheets around, scramble ocean circulation, and kick off a thousand-year climate episode, that's not subtle. You'd expect scars, not theory. Scars. The impact hypothesis already leans on specific geological markers. You've heard about them. Some labs see the signals. Others don't. That debate is real. But the deeper pressure point isn't the lab argument. It's geography. Where did this thing actually hit? Well, depending on the paper, the proposed impact zone moves. North America, Greenland, multiple airbursts, fragment swarm, atmospheric detonation. Each revision tries to keep the model alive. But let's talk craters. Burkle Crater gets floated around, an undersea structure in the Indian Ocean. It's interesting shape, possible impact origin, but the dating? Murky. Direct tie to 12,900 years ago? Well, that's still debated. Then Hiawatha shows up under Greenland ice in 2018. Big, dramatic. For a minute, it looked promising. Then the dating work came in, and it doesn't lock cleanly to the younger Dryas window. It might be older, possibly much older. So that one doesn't sit neatly in the timeline either. So step back. If this was a global scale comet event, you'd expect a clean ejecta layer, something synchronized across continents, something you can point to without squinting. Instead, the signals are patchy, present here, absent there. So that doesn't kill the hypotheses, but when a model keeps adjusting to survive each objection, you start noticing the adjustments. Meanwhile, a sufficiently large solar outburst doesn't require a crater, no debris field and no missing hole, just energy, atmospheric disturbance, radiation signatures. Now, that doesn't make solar proven, but it does mean fewer moving parts. And when you're weighing explanations, the one that needs less scaffolding usually deserves a harder look. So we've got meltwater, which needs a trigger. We've got a comet, which needs a hole in the ground that we can all agree on. And then there's the option people don't love because it doesn't leave a dramatic scar, the sun. We know from tree rings that there have been violent solar outbursts in the past. Carbon-14 spikes show up. Beryllium-10 anomalies show up. The so-called Miyake events. Radiation bursts strong enough to leave fingerprints in trees across continents. In 1775 CE, there's a massive carbon-14 spike recorded in tree rings across the planet. Same signal in Japan, same signal in Europe, the same signal in North America. That wasn't a local storm, that was solar. Now scale that back 10,000 years, and we don't have written records, but we do have proxy data. We know the sun is capable of punching harder than we'd like to admit. We also observe solar superflares on stars like ours. It's not science fiction, it's just telescopes. A sufficiently intense solar event wouldn't leave a crater. It would leave atmospheric chaos, electrical disruption, climate knock-on effects, maybe ice sheet destabilization if the timing's right. Now, let me be careful. There is no stamped, framed, case-closed consensus that the sun caused the Younger Dryas. But if you're looking for a global forcing mechanism that acts fast, leaves atmospheric fingerprints, doesn't require a missing impact site, and can cascade through climate systems, you don't have to twist yourself into knots. And here's the part that matters. Comets are random. Solar cycles are not. That doesn't prove anything. But when you line the models up and ask which one feels like it needs fewer duct tape assumptions, one of them breathes easier. And that's worth sitting with. There's something else that changes after the reset. It's not architecture at first, it's attention. Civilizations stop looking mostly at the ground and start organizing around the sky. Now, let's be careful here. Humans have always noticed the sun. It grows crops, it warms skin, it marks time. So of course it matters. That's baseline. But post-Ice Age civilization doesn't just appreciate the sun, it organizes around it. In Egypt, Ra isn't just daylight, he's the ordering principle of existence. In Mesopotamia, Shamash isn't just light, he's law, justice, measurement. In Mesoamerica, Tonatilu isn't background scenery, entire calendar systems are built around solar precision. In the Andes, Inti isn't symbolic decoration. Political power runs through solar lineage. So this isn't casual gratitude toward daylight, it's structural. Architecture aligns to solar movement. Ritual timing locks into solstices. Authority roots itself in the sky. And, well, the timing is interesting. These solar-centered civilizations rise after the Younger Dryas window closes, after the climate snap, after the sea level surge. Now, let's not get sloppy. Sun worship does not equal solar catastrophe. Correlation is not causation. But here's the pressure point. If something from above destabilized the planet hard enough to reset coastlines, would the next civilizations ignore the sky? Or would they watch it carefully? We know they watched it carefully. Because you have stone alignments, solar calendars, monument orientation that tracks the sun with obsessive precision. That's not decoration, that's attention. And when flood myths describe the heavens opening, when destruction comes from above, you don't have to stretch too far to understand why sky behavior would become sacred. Again, this does not prove a solar event, but it makes solar plausible without gymnastics. especially when radiation spikes show up in tree rings. We observe solar superflares on stars like ours. A universally agreed impact crater hasn't settled the comet debate. One mechanism leaves a hole. The other leaves energy. Early civilizations behave like people who learn to track the sky with discipline. That's not mystical. That's memory under pressure. If the sky wants to destabilize the world, reverence might not be worship. It might be caution. Here's something that doesn't get talked about much. We still build arcs. We just don't call them that. Up in Svalbard, tucked into the Arctic permafrost, there's the Global Seed Vault. It's not subtle. It's a concrete tunnel drilled into a mountain. Inside, you have backup copies of crop seeds from all over the planet. Wheat, rice, barley, the stuff that keeps grocery stores boring and predictable. It exists in case something goes sideways. Not a bad harvest, something bigger. And that's not the only one. Governments maintain continuity plans, bunkers, hardened facilities, backup communication networks, data centers built in mountains and old missile silos. The internet itself is built with redundancy layered on redundancy because the assumption is simple. Things break. We mirror hard drives. We store copies of copies. We back up the backup. That's not paranoia. That's engineering. But step back for a second. When ancient stories talk about preserving animals, seeds, law, knowledge, that sounds less like bedtime mythology and more like continuity planning. If your civilization collapses once and you survive, well, you don't just rebuild houses. You build systems to make sure the next collapse doesn't erase everything. That's human. And it makes the flood stories feel less theatrical. Because what if they weren't just telling a water story? What if they were encoding a lesson? Preserve the seeds, preserve the knowledge. Preserve something that outlasts you. We do that instinctively now, which raises an uncomfortable possibility. Maybe the oldest story on Earth isn't about water. Maybe it's about what happens after you almost lose everything and the quiet fear that you might again. Or maybe it's simpler than that. Maybe it's just about forgetting. So let's take a breath before this turns into a History Channel marathon. We do not have proof of some crystal-powered Atlantis with floating towers and laser dolphins. There is no recovered blueprint of a lost supercity sitting in a museum drawer. That part is fantasy until someone drags it up from the ocean floor. What we do have is documented climate snap at the end of the last ice age. That's not fringe. That's ice cores and sediment layers. We have sea levels rising enough to swallow coastlines that humans absolutely would have lived on. We have flood memories showing up in cultures that never shared campfires. We have myths that don't just talk about rain, they talk about a reset, a before and an after. And we have stories that say knowledge didn't start from scratch, it was carried, taught, and reintroduced. None of that proves a lost advanced civilization, but it does poke holes in the idea that nothing organized existed before 10,000 BC, except for small bands of confused cave painters. That version feels incomplete and ridiculous. And here's the part that matters. Memory compresses trauma. It strips out detail and keeps structure. If you survive something big enough, you don't preserve spreadsheets. You preserve the outline. Water, loss, few survive, start over. That's how humans remember. So maybe the flood stories aren't literal weather reports. Maybe they're just scar tissue. And maybe what makes them powerful isn't the water. It's the admission buried inside them. We survived something once. We carried the memory forward. We lost the details, but we kept the story. So, listen, thank you for staying with me all the way through this. I'm Ralph, and this is Divergent Files. If this episode made you think, I'd appreciate if you'd like it, share it, and subscribe. That's how this thing grows. No big machine behind it, just us trying to make sense of a world that doesn't always make sense. We're going to do it one story at a time. So until next time, stay curious, stay grounded, and remember, no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there.